Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the An Unexpected Fight, a pediatric cancer podcast. Today we have an awesome guest on the show, and I'm so excited to have him here. This is Dr. Neelay Shaw. He is a clinician scientist and associate professor in the Division of Hematology, Oncology, and Bone Marrow Transplant at Nationwide Children's Hospital. His primary clinical focus is on pediatric solid tumors, including neuroblastomas, tumor of the kidneys, and rare solid tumors of childhood. His research focuses on molecular drivers of pediatric cancer and how new treatment approaches can be taken to better target these drivers. In this role, he works to identify new uses of currently available anti-cancer treatment, including drugs originally developed for the use against cancers in adults. He serves as the Associate Director for Liver Tumor, Kidney Tumor, Germ Cell, and Neuroblastoma Targeted Therapies, and is currently the sponsor and study principal investigator of the CABO Main Trial, a Phase 2 study evaluating the efficacy of the oral anti-cancer agent, CABO, as a maintenance therapy for ultra-high-risk solid tumors. He also serves as the co-director of the Cancer Genetics Program. This program serves to advance the use of genetic and genomic evaluations for the benefits of patients. In this role, he sees patients in the Cancer Predisposition Clinic for evaluation, surveillance, and management of patients with genetic alterations that predispose cancer development. He also consults on patients for precision oncology, partnering with the Institute of Genomic Medicine to identify therapeutic approaches based on the patient tumor and germline genomics. Dr. Shaw is a graduate in the Honors Program of the Medical Education at Northwestern University, earning his medical degree in 2003. He completed residency in general pediatrics in 2006 at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and a fellowship in pediatric hematology oncology at Johns Hopkins University and the National Cancer Institute in 2011. He was also the research instructor at Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., prior to his arrival at Nationwide Children's Hospital in 2013, which is where he's currently working. Dr. Shaw, thank you so much for being here with us. Your bio is quite impressive, and I can't wait to get into talking to you more.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So a little bit about how Dr. Shaw and I met. We went to the National Pediatric Cancer Sunshine Project Summit, and we got to talking after the summit and really just went from there. And now we've met and are doing this podcast and hopefully doing some other things later in the year. So I'm really excited to talk about all of this stuff.
Absolutely.
So Dr. Shaw, thank you so much. Like Tiffany said, I'm just going to reiterate, we know how busy you are clearly with that bio. So the fact that you took time out to talk with us here, really, really appreciate it. I also met you at our research summit this year. And that was one of my first questions. If you could tell us a little bit about what you appreciate about the Sunshine Project and what sets NPCF apart in terms of funding and research. We know there's a lot of pediatric cancer foundations out there, but one thing I hear time and time again from those of you that I meet at Research Summit is how much you really appreciate this consortium and how incredible it is. So if you could tell us just a little bit more about that and what you think kind of sets us apart, we'd love to hear it.
Of course. The Sunshine Project is really just so fantastic because it is so collaborative and so positive. So Damon Reed, as you guys know, established consortium, and his philosophy in life is there's a way forward. And as a result, everyone who comes together at the Sunshine Project, which at this point is over 30 institutions and really high powered institutions, including us at Nationwide Children's, CHOP, Children's of Colorado, And when we come together, everyone's talking about such an expanse of topics and concepts and diseases. Usually meetings are very siloed. You're working on leukemia, you're working on brain tumors, you're working on sarcomas. And here it's everything is a good idea because everything needs help. I call it oncology improv because no one says no. It's always yes and. If you identify an issue, you said you identify the issue, but you quickly try to figure out, what's a workaround? What's a way that we can move forward past that? Because it shouldn't be an obstruction to what's going forward. And that's really just fantastic. It's really great to be able to see that diversity of diseases, because we can and should learn from each other. When you're siloed off in your own diseases, you get really kind of tunnel vision. And you know, there is a lot of overlapping biology between these different diseases and opportunities to collaborate in that way. You know, as an example, there was a new therapeutic that's being pushed forward, and you know, it was being looked at, obviously, in trying to do this in a somewhat confidential way. You know, it was being studied in one set of tumor types. And someone said, this model should work over here, too. What do we think? And so everyone said, great, let's figure out how to feather that in. And now we've got another arm that's going to be including that as well. So really getting as many of these new innovative approaches to patients as broadly as possible and as quickly as possible. And the operations at Sunshine Project are really fantastic. They're great to work with. Every institution really collaborates in that way. And they're very, very egalitarian. For the committee calls, it's not you're selected and you know, it's a confidential process that you have to apply for. And they're like, are you interested? Show up. If you're not interested, we'll send you updates anyway. And so that forward-thinking approach is really just dynamic and energizing. So. The match of that is NPCF. You know, it's taken, I think, all of us in the consortium some time to learn really about, like, you know, the deep history of it, you know, how much it predated Sunshine in that way. But you guys are so powerful and so effective in your fundraising and in pulling your community together. I mean, you're a relatively tight region. Down there in Florida, you know, you're not like some of the other foundations where you have a national presence, but you are just out there and bringing stuff back to us. And whenever you do, it's every year. I feel like we come to the in-person summit in February, and Dave Frazier comes and says, "Hey, we got an extra couple million here. What can you guys do with this?" And the process of getting from philanthropy to patient is also really streamlined. It's not cheapened. You guys aren't just handing money away. You're really making sure that they're high quality projects. But we in the project really try to remove as many obstructions as possible to getting there, so we can really kind of speed things up. It's such a fantastic program on both sides. And really a model for what we should be doing across pediatric oncology.
Well, thank you for that. As a nurse and a cancer mom, being in that room and listening to you guys throw around ideas, like you said, and just everyone openly discussing it and calling each other out and saying, nope, what about this? What about that? Tiffany can attest to this. It's incredible. And I think it would give a lot of families, if they're listening in, hope that there are people out there that are truly fighting to find these answers. So thank you for that.
Of course. Thank you.
Yeah. I echo everything Kelly said. It's definitely incredible to see all of the great minds come together and really just brainstorm. And I told Kelly that was probably thus far the highlight of my career. And I've been in oncology for 12 years. And so it really sets apart to me what it means to be a researcher and to be a clinician taking care of these pediatric patients. So, Dr. Shaw, what do you think drives your passion for pediatric oncology, and how did you get into the field?
So I always tell our trainees that oncologists, particularly pediatric oncologists, we're born, we're not made. It's in us. We just have to discover it. So I had completed my undergraduate career. I'd been in a basic science lab, and I liked the science, but it was studying yeast. And I needed something that was a little bit more applicable. And so someone said, well, why don't you go ask the head of the cancer center? So this is the Lurie Cancer Center at Northwestern. And I'm just, you're insane. I'm an undergraduate who's going to med school. Why would he talk to me? And I sent in an email, and it's Dr. Rosen, Steve Rosen, and he very graciously said, come on down, let's talk. And he said two things to me. One, you know, med school's hard, right? And then he said, well, if you want to do this, I've got two labs that I can direct you towards. And one studies cancers in patients with HIV, and one studies cancers in kids. And I really hadn't thought much about pediatric oncology at that point. So I go into that lab, and this is the lab of Dr. Susan Cohn, who's now at University of Chicago. At that point, she's at Northwestern. And it was really just so fantastic to kind of see the biology of these diseases. And neuroblastoma itself is really just this beautiful monster. You know, in kids under 18 months of age, it forms and can go away on its own. You can force differentiate into nerves. It can act like it's trying to be normal. And then there's this, and then that switch at 18 months where all of a sudden it just goes haywire. And it kind of reminds me of gremlins, right? Like when they're cute and fuzzy versus when they're green and slimy. And it's such a different disease biology, and we still are figuring it out. But, you know, this was in the late 90s at that point. You know, it was 99 to 2003 that I was at med school, and we were still kind of elucidating so much. And so I really kind of got into it. And after 3 months, the lab manager there is like, oh, you're still here. Okay, we should give you a real project. That was kind of their filter. You know, they had a lot of people who'd come through and say, you know, something I kind of want to do, and then they fade away. But I got bit, and then later that year, I started following Dr. Cohn in her clinic, and she's like, yeah, just show up Tuesday mornings, and I had my white coat on, and they're like, I walk in, and she's not quite there yet, and they're like, I'm here to be following Dr. Cohn, and they're like, great, pick up a chart. And just meeting the patients, it was done. This is what I was meant to do. Kids are super balls. They bounce, so they can take so much more than we do. And they certainly have fear. They understand what to be afraid of, but they're open-minded and they can be coached through it. And it just makes it so much more enjoyable. And you know, they can be, you know, as you both unfortunately know, you know, they can be puking their guts out and then go right back to playing with their Lego. If you reflect that openness and that honesty with them, they deserve it and they appreciate it, and you build these relationships. And it's really, you know, whenever I tell people what I do, which I'm always skittish about, you know, it's, I have to emphasize it. I'm like, no, it's so much more rewarding and I get so much more out of it than I possibly could return to families.
That's incredible. Thank you for sharing that. It's true. There's no stronger person out there than a kid that's fighting cancer. The way they bounce right back up and you look at them, you're like, how are you doing that right now? You know, my daughter, after her third brain surgery, was standing in her crib, just pulling on the JP drain. And I'm like, that's not normal. So there's good, but she's smiling and chuckling, and you're like, after, you know, three back-to-back surgeries, how is this feasible? So it's no secret that the pediatric oncology world is kind of a gray area at times. We don't get near as much funding and attention as adult oncology and a lot of other disease processes out there. So do you mind talking, and I know this is kind of open-ended question, but do you mind talking about maybe some of the common misconceptions about pediatric oncology in general?
Sure. So the first misconception is what we see in TV ads. I had asked a group of students once, of like, when you are told pediatric cancer, what do you think? And the best answer I got was, like those ASPCA ads with dogs, but with kids. And I don't want to minimize what the kids go through by any means, but it is not just atrocious. And we have made great strides. And I need to emphasize, it's we as that broad international community. Really, it's not really just one institution or another institution. It's all of us partnering together in lots of different ways, including ways like Sunshine Project, to make those advances. So one, it's letting people know, like, no, this is a meaningful effort, and we really help a lot. Astoundingly, the other misconception I get is, oh, I thought we fixed that. I thought all the kids survived cancer now. I thought that was a non-problem now. It's like, no, we have a lot of disparity there. And so while for some diseases, we've made great strides in, you know, curing well over 90% of kids, there's a lot of toxicity still there and a lot of room for improvement. And obviously at the other extreme is, again, as you guys know, you know, we still have a lot of way to go with our ped solid tumors and particularly our neuro-oncology tumors as well. And so we need to keep up that fight. And the third is that again, going back to that notion of there's more than just a couple institutions, you know, where we are, the adult oncology institution, the James, which we are a component of the OSU, Conference of Cancer Center, you know, the James really gets the name and the recognition. You know, whenever I go to a restaurant and say, oh, would you like to donate, you know, X amount of money to this institution in a different state? You know, it's a little frustrating that, like, well, no, this is a broader fight, and there are ways to keep that support in our community the way that NPCF does really, really so well. So, you know, so I think that reminding people that this is a fight that needs to be fought and deserves it. Not to minimize what happens in adults with cancers, because that's tragic too. But when you look at dollar of investment to gain of life, and that calculation, the only two cancer types really have that by far and away log folds higher return on that type of investment. It's breast cancer and children's cancers, and you know, because we don't want to just give these kids 6 months of life or a year of life. You know, a lot of drug companies, those are their benchmarks for their trials of extending their 6 month progression free survival. No, we want cured. We want done. And we want them to be able to live the rest of their life as healthily as possible. And so that's where a lot of it's community engagement and really getting that word out.
So what's nice, you know,
now, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The other thing that's really changed is, you know, you go back 50 years ago, and if a kid had cancer, it wasn't discussed. The kid was taken home and palliated, and that was that. And then it was into the phase of, well, it's tragic and it's horrible. And now we talk about it. And right. Now we acknowledge it, that it's something that affects all of our communities in that way. And really bringing it back to, this isn't one family's fight. Or a niche topic. This is something that really affects all of us.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, taking care of adult cancer patients anytime, and they can be like down and sad and they're woe is me, but then somehow they end up finding about my story and about my daughter, and then like it all changes. They're like, I'm so sorry. So I honestly think that anybody that has an adult cancer would rather our research funding go to children, because they know, like, they've lived. A lot of them, not all, but I mean, of course, there's young people, younger adults that get cancer. But, you know, for the most part, it's a disease of aging. And I feel like the majority of my cancer patients would go, please don't research my cancer. Like, please find a cure for the kids. I really do. I'm like, I wish that Big Pharma or whoever would ask, like, hey, would y'all rather find a cure for? And I overwhelmingly know that these patients would certainly pick kids. And then the other comment I had, so I think a huge misconception, and this is nothing against this hospital, but a lot of people see commercials for St. Jude, and people assume that that's where kids with cancer need to be or need to go, or where they need to send all their money. You talked a little bit about all these different institutions. Can you just like elaborate a little bit about why we don't necessarily need every kid to go to St. Jude? For example, Nora would have been better off going to Hackensack in New Jersey, because that's where the leading researcher was for ETMR. So I'd like to you to address that just a little bit too.
Sorry about that. All right.
That's okay.
I couldn't figure out how to mute the mic. No, it's like, I hit the mic button and it was like, well, you can, well, it's like, what? I don't know what it is. Yeah, so sorry. One, as I mentioned, the only way that we've made the advances in pediatric cancers is by working as a community. Child cancers occur at a far less frequent rate than adult cancers, certainly. There's about 10 to 15,000 cases of childhood cancer per year in the U.S. compared to north of 275,000 cases of just lung cancer in adults per year. So we're comparatively smaller. So we have to work collaboratively. And as a result, that knowledge has really been spread out across the nation, academically, institutions for higher learning and high-powered medical institutions have realized that we need to make those advances in peds cancer because it also informs what's going on in the adult side. You know, so much going forward now is talking about epigenetics, and so much of that was really spearheaded in our pediatric tumor in that way too. So it's spread out in that way, but there are well over 100 different tertiary care pediatric institutions across the nation that really have the expertise and the wherewithal to know how to treat your child in your community. Cancer wrecks your life. I can't think of a bigger wrecking ball, and particularly pediatric cancer, because it wrecks your whole family's life. And to disrupt that, to uproot, to go to somewhere else, isn't always in the best interest. For many cancers, what we're doing, as the current standard of care, is available everywhere and will work really well for so many of those cancers. For many others, we have clinical trials available at your local institution. That's really the story of Nationwide Children's. And circa the early 2000s, we'd been Columbus Children's Hospital, and that had been around for over 100 years. It was a local community institution. And one of our former chairs, their child had a medical issue, and they were told, you have to go to Cleveland or Cincinnati to address this because we don't have that resource here. And that family said no. That the children of Central Ohio deserve better than that and have built now Nationwide Children's. And from there, it was, our first tower. And we had a research institution that's exploded. And then we recruited in the Institute for Genomic Medicine and Rick Wilson and Elaine Martis. We just keep growing and going and going. And that is one story for us. And that story is told at many, many institutions across the nation. So you don't necessarily have to go across the country just to one or two institutions. Those institutions have done a lot for us in pediatric oncology and bringing that awareness to our diseases. But that's where it just has to have that conversation. I feel like with every family that comes in, eventually that conversation happens, whether it's with St. Jude's or a different institution. So I talk it through with them and I say, this is why. And I tell them too, it's like, if you want to hear it from them, I'm happy to talk with them. And inevitably those institutions say, stay put where you are. You're in good hands and keep going that way. So, it's a double-edged sword but that's where it's the job of the rest of our peds oncology community to remind everyone, we all are here. There's certainly going to be some areas where you're going to be geographically limited, particularly out in Big Sky country. But for so many other places, there's a great care group really close to you.
Awesome. Well said. I agree. And the collaborative approach in the peds oncology world, it's very important. And I think, pediatric cancer parents out there are very appreciative that a lot of you, maybe not everybody, but a lot of you are communicating and open to, okay, you want a second opinion? Like, let me reach out to this person. Let me get, resources here. I think that some of these tumors are considered more rare than others. And it's important to really get all the feedback you can. You are a very, very smart man, but nobody knows everything about, you know, this one particular tumor, for instance. But if you kind of collaborate, everybody can kind of help each other out. And I think we need more of that. So thank you for openly sharing that with us. Speaking of research, we obviously heard about all the amazing work you're doing in your bio, your very long bio. That was incredible. But can you tell us a little bit more about your research and the trial you're working on, the CABOMAIN trial?
Sure. So very few new drugs are developed for children's cancers. However, there are a number of drugs that have been developed by pharmacology groups for the over the last 20 years that are really changing the dynamic of treatments. I was in fellowship when Gleevec, the first oral drug for chronic myeloid leukemia, came out, and I remember hearing from a hematologist oncologist that said, this isn't going to change a thing. We're still going to be having to transplant all these patients. 2 years later, he is writing up a commentary, singing its praises that have it's changed the whole dynamic. And we need that in peds. And so what we're finding is that a lot of the drugs that have been developed on the adult side, while not with that intention of being applied for kids, have relevance. And so that's really what so much of my research is about finding out what are those pathways that have commonality between adult tumors and adult drugs available for adult cancers and our pediatric tumors. And so to that end, to kind of make this story relatively brief, we had a patient with a rare version of a kidney cancer in kids. It's a renal cell carcinoma, which there is a type of that in adult that's much more prevalent in kids. The biology is a little bit different. It was not responding to any of the treatments we had available. And we were approaching hospice. And then I got that second opinion. The family said, can we get a second opinion? I said, please do, because this is such an unusual rare tumor. And I'll call out Dr. Peely because he really was so helpful. And I've told him this story too. So Roberto Peely, who at that point was at Roswell Park, now he's at University of Buffalo, did a very pleasant, thorough job of providing a second opinion, and had a kind of really just a bonus line at the end of like some of the newer small molecule drugs may have benefit in renal cell carcinoma. I asked for the insurance company. They gave approval for cabozantinib. And cabo is very unique in that, unlike a lot of drugs where your goal is to try to target one thing very specifically, cabo really targets multiple cancer pathways at once. So, you know, Gleevec, as I mentioned, it really tries to go after that BCR-ABL mutation. It has a little bit of kind of off-target effect, but it's meant to be targeted that way. Cabo is intentionally multi-targeted. And that's really nice for our pediatric cancers, where there may not be one thing driving the tumor fully. So we got approval for the drug, started her on it. A month later, she came back. She had gained 17 pounds. Her pleural effusion had gone away, and really got high quality of life. Eventually, the tumor figured it out, and she progressed. But she got 17 great months of high quality of life. We tried it in a second patient. Between that combination and a little bit of kind of different strategy and on timing of use, he got 6 years of life with stage 4 disease, which should kill him in 6 months. We read up our experience. Exelixis, the company that makes cabozantinib, came to us and said, thank you for describing your experience. Let's talk. Fast forward, they're supporting us for this clinical trial. So there are a number of pediatric cancers where we can get them into a remission, but we can't keep them. Relapsed neuroblastoma, metastatic osteosarcoma, metastatic Ewing sarcoma, relapsed refractory solid tumors kind of more broadly. It's really so horrifying to families that we get done with that frontline or that relapse therapy and put them back into a remission and then say, great, we're going to sit and watch now. And they know, but it's that it's going to come back. But we don't really know what to do. In those other cases that I described and some others I didn't describe, we found that by giving cabozantinib afterwards, we could extend that period of remission and in some cases really cure the kids. And so that's how we're approaching this. So we have three strata. This is all available on clinicaltrials.gov. If you search cabomain, C-A-B-O-M-A-I-N, you'll be able to find it pretty quickly. It's you have to have entered some type of disease control. That can be a complete remission. That can just be stable disease. But you have to have off that treatment for a month, whatever your last therapy was. That could be chemo. That could be drug. That could be radiation. It could be surgery even. And then just confirm that you're not progressing. And if you're not progressing, then we put you on cabo. Unfortunately, at this point, there's only a tablet formulation. But we've gotten kids who are pretty young able to swallow these pills. They're not horse pills by any means. And you're on that drug for up to a year. And towards that goal of trying to minimize impact and quality of life, we really try to minimize how frequently you have to come to one of our sites. We're now open at three additional sites in addition to nationwide here in Columbus. We are open at Children's of Colorado in Denver, Primary Children's at Utah, and UAB, Alabama, Birmingham. We have three more sites that are pending as well. So we're really trying to get as much coverage as possible. But even then, you're talking about a total of 8 to 9 visits total to your site over the course of that year. And after the first 3 months, we really try to space out those visits, doing as much management with that local team as possible. Going forward in future studies, we'd love to be able to really follow a virtual research model. I know that a lot of groups are looking into that. It's too preliminary for this study, unfortunately. But we're still open. We're open to accrual. And we've had a number of patients who've been able to complete their therapy and are now being followed for their survival. All magic has a cost, and all drugs have side effects. It's not chemo. We're not going to bottom out your counts in that way. But it's something that we can walk through. And I always make myself available to the site PI as well, or the referring physician, as well as to that family to say, this is what it looks like. And these are the things that think
about. Awesome. One thing I'd like to point out that you said, you know, you're talking about these being more targeted agents that you're able to use. And, you know, whenever I hear that, more targeted to me means less toxicity for the patient. So I think that's just a really important thing to point out. Like, what you're studying is not highly toxic chemotherapy that's going to cause these patients lifelong illnesses and injury to their heart or their lungs or peripheral neuropathy or all these other things that they can develop. These are things that, yeah, they have side effects, but they're more temporary and not so life altering. So I love that you're able to offer these patients this drug. So what changes do you wish to see happen in pediatric oncology in the next decade? I know that's a loaded question.
That's a loaded question.
No question.
So the first change, and this is starting to happen, is having pharma come to us and approach us more. As part of my work mission, it's really to go and find those drugs and find those companies, bring them to us. So every year I go to the big meeting in Chicago in June, ASCO, and I hit really as much as possible every booth that's down there and see exactly what's going on. And the number of times that I say, you know, there's a story for this in kids' cancers, they're like, really? And I'm like, yes. And that story's been written about for 20 years. We just haven't found a way to make it move forward. And so bringing them to us. To that end, and also because so many more of these drugs are becoming available in PEDS tumors, we need to learn about them. When, like I said, you know, the first of these drugs really came to clinical approval when I was in fellowship. So there's, and I'm not that old. And so there's a number of oncologists that don't know really how to manage these drugs and how to best utilize them, what sequence, things like that. And then the new trainees need to learn all of these on top of the chemotherapy. So we'll be hosting at Nationwide Children's Targeted Therapy Symposium. And more than that, once we proposed it as a targeted therapy symposium, I thought, wait a minute, you need to know what to target first. And so that's the other part that needs to come along too. And we are leading that in peds compared to adults, certainly, is identification of those targets. So we have that Institute for Genomic Medicine that we mentioned, really a world-class leader in so much of the technology and so many of these analyses that are possible. And so we're leveraging that knowledge as well. So it's actually the Pediatric Integrative Diagnostics and Targeted Therapy Symposium. And so with that, we'll have one day of really talking about from needle to mock tumor board, of like what type of evaluations they need to do in these tumors, how to best get that tissue, really how do we work that through for the clinicians. Day two is going to be current therapies and really what's becoming available. I'm going to get back to day two in a second. Day three is going to be what's in the future. But as part of day two, we're also going to be looking at, in the afternoon, some of these kind of less rigorous medical concerns, but that are as important. So supportive care, getting nursing support, pharmacology support, but also family payer and pharma viewpoints. And so we're getting representatives from each of those groups, and I've invited Tiffany to come as both hats, really, as both a someone in the field, but also a family member and a mother, to talk about really what are the viewpoints on that, because it's not always uniform. Sometimes the powers that be think, oh, kids can't handle that, it's like, and the families say, no, we can. And sometimes they say, oh, well, that's not ethical to do to a kid, and the families say, well, why would that be? And so we're getting that engagement that way. And with that, we're hoping to get more and more of that pharma involvement in that way. So that's number one, is getting all the powers on the same page to come to PEDSONG. And to that end, using more and more of these target agents earlier and earlier in therapy, PEDSONG has always been known for combination therapies. You know, that's what we figured out in leukemia and then marched that through everything else. And so one of these drugs alone may not be sufficient to necessarily cure. But if we can use that drug and reduce the doses of the other chemo drugs and attack it in a more clever way.
Right.
There's a fantastic pair of papers called the Hallmarks of Cancer. And then 10 years later, they did an update called The Next Generation. But it really talks about how, you know, it's not just about damaging DNA and preventing replication. It's about affecting blood supply to the tumor. It's about affecting how they get their energy, their metabolomics. And it's about impacting how the cancer abuses the immune system to not only ignore it, but to protect the cancer and those types of things. And so by using these other drugs that don't just go after replicating cells, but affect blood supply to the tumor and change how that tumor microenvironment is, that's how we're going to move forward. That's how we're going to get that last 20% of kids cured, and how we're going to get that whole 100% of kids cured with far less toxicity.
So, you know, you were talking some about the targeted therapy, and we were talking about the adults. So, you know, I hear the coin term a lot, kids are not small adults. But do you think, as far as now that we're talking about NGS testing, we're talking about the biology, the genetic makeup of the tumor, do you think that we will see more and more that we're able to use adult drugs for pediatric tumors?
Yes, with an asterisk. So while we are expanding dramatically the evaluation, not only with NGS, but with other next gen approaches of evaluating these tumors. Because when I was going through fellowship, you know, it was 5% of tumors have any type of family cancer predisposition in that way. And now we're finding that by sequencing more and more of these tumors and then the patients, it's a match. We're finding that number's probably low. It's probably higher. And there are a lot of genes that we're finding, like, hey, there's a story for this in adults. We just didn't know to check for it in kids. And it might be 3-4% of kids, but that, you know, that's one gene, and then it adds up and adds up. So in those ways, we'll find for the kids with specific mutations that are driving the tumors new opportunities. The other way is going to be, the story is not just DNA. I use the metaphor that, you know, we've all heard DNA is the blueprint of the cell. And that's wrong, because you don't leave things off of a blueprint. DNA is the menu to the restaurant that is your cell. And so DNA is the menu. RNA is the ticket. That's the server writes. And then protein is the food that's created. But the other thing is the modifications to that menu. The on sale now or sold out, all those different adjustments that are made up to that menu. So we call those epigenetics. And there's layers and layers and layers of that. Really starting to get into kind of a multi-dimensional approach. And for better or for worse, AI is really going to be the thing that's going to help us to identify a lot of that. I'm going to leave that alone.
That's a whole other podcast episode.
A whole other podcast. I got a good buddy in Chicago I'll point you to. So. But by being able to do more and more of those analyses, and those are the types of things that IGM and other institutions, you know, Dana-Farber, St. Jude's, University of Chicago certainly are also advancing a lot of those approaches. But by getting more and more of those methods in line, that's where we're going to find more and more of these adult drugs that have a relevance in kids that way. It's going to take some process and some organization. To that end, the NCI has a fantastic effort right now, the CCDI, the Childhood Cancer Data Initiative. And again, it's about bringing everyone together in that way. And how do we collect all that information? And within that, there's something we call the Molecular Characterization Initiative. And that's where we're doing a lot of that deep sequencing and making it available to all COG sites. So you don't have to be just at Nationwide Children's to get that type of data available to you. We've been spoiled in that way and being able to do that, as some of the other institutions like Texas Children's and some of the other ones I've mentioned as well. But now we really want to say, this should be available across the nation. If you're at a site that should be taking care of kids with cancer, you should have access to this. And we will learn and we will apply as well. And we're getting more and more studies targeted in that way too. So just like in the adult side, there's the match protocol where you get sequenced. We see what the mutation is, see what trial makes sense for you. We have the peds match. And we just keep adding on more and more drugs in that way to say, okay, this can be applied in this set of tumors and that. It's nibbling away at it, but that's the only way we're going to get at this, because kids' cancers are so varied and so diverse.
Thank you for that. And for everybody who's listening who maybe does not have a medical background, as Tiffany and I are like, yes, we love this. NGS, how would you explain to the layperson, because we might have a lot of cancer families and parents listening and going, okay, they're talking about NGS testing and genetic markers and tumor makeup. When we talk about targeted therapies, we're talking about targeting like a mutation or something in the tumor. How would you explain that maybe in lay terms for people who have made it this far into the podcast and their heads are exploding?
Sure. So I'll talk about NGS first, and then I'll talk about targeted therapy. So NGS, the idea here is that really trying to find newer, faster methods to evaluate the molecular aspects of the cancer. So when we talk about the molecular aspects, people usually think the DNA, the genes. Is there a mutation or a change that's happened in this gene that's making the cancer form or stay alive or be aggressive and spread or things like that? And usually, once you get past a certain point, there's a bunch of different kind of changes that start to happen in that way. In the bad old days, to do that DNA sequencing, you had to basically start at one end of the chromosome and just literally read each letter one at a time. And so you got through all 6 billion base pairs. They figured out ways that you can kind of shortcut that reliably still. You're still getting good data and informative data, but it takes a fraction of the time. So now, under that molecular characterization initiative, once tumor has arrived, which we happen to do those analyses at Nationwide Children's at the IGM, it takes on average about 2 weeks for us to do a comprehensive evaluation of about 200 plus different genes that have relevance in cancer. And then also some other associated changes that can happen. So we look at things called mutations, where there's a specific single change or small change within a gene that turns it on or off. There are things that are called fusions, where the chromosome breaks and glues back together in the wrong way. And so, you know, you can have two different chromosomes, and if they break, then they flip, and now they're glued on that way. And that changes how they're turned on and off and what proteins are produced and things like that. So there's a different set of analyses that we do there. And those are targeted in a different way as well. And then there's something called methylation, which is that that epigenetics. It's the one of many layers, but it's a reliably accessible layer that we can test that better tells us, okay, we're looking at this tumor. Is it actually the thing we think it is, or is it more related to something else? And that's the first step that we're taking there. So that's what we're talking about, these new molecular methods. Now, that's just the DNA side of it. There's a lot of other analysis that has to happen in these tumors too. And many of those are what's sticking out on the outside of the tumor and what we call the immunophenotype. So you can then test for that and say, okay, this protein is sticking out or that protein is sticking out. When these were first described, there was a group that decided we're not going to figure out what these actual proteins are. We're just going to determine that they're all different. And so they're going to call them a cluster of differentiation or CD and then give them a number. So you might see out there, they talk about, you know, CD19 or CD22 or CD123, and the numbers keep going. We know what those proteins are now, but for ease, we still use that number. So that's the other part of that analysis. And there are other different aspects that are coming along too that are kind of those. All those molecular analyses are important because that's what gets to then the targeted therapies. So some targeted therapies are the small molecules. Those, many of those don't target the DNA specifically. They target that net end result protein that's abnormal and generally are trying to inhibit it. Generally, you're trying to turn those abnormal proteins off. So that's one type of small molecule drug, is that that attacks these abnormal proteins and tries to block them. Or if they're not mutated, but they're just on excessively because the cell needs that to be on. You know, some of those, for example, get new blood supply to the cell. And so if you can block that new blood supply, you starve out the cell in that way. So some of those drugs target those proteins in their function. Other drugs do get into the cell and target the DNA, usually not by hitting the DNA directly, but some of those epigenetic changes and turning things that are off back on and vice versa, or really mucking up the works so that the cell can't produce what it needs to make. The third type of targeted therapy broadly is the immunotherapy. And generally there, you're looking at targeting those surface markers on the cell. So in leukemia, for example, I think we've all heard about CAR T cells in some way. Emily Whitehead being the first patient who was treated at CHOP, and they basically re-engineered the patient's immune cells to go after something that was on the cancer cell, something called CD19. And so it would go around and it would find the cells that had that, attack it, get rid of it, and then keep going. And that's been expanded out. CAR T cells are one way to do that. You can make antibodies. So just like all of us make antibodies because we're exposed to the world, you're exposed to an illness or you're exposed to a vaccine, and then your body wants to be prepared for that for the next time. So it makes an immune response, makes antibodies against that. Well, we can do that in a lab too. We can take those antibodies and engineer them so they can go after the cancer cells too. So there's lots of different ways that the new methods of testing are making these new classes of drugs available. And again, not to advertise this too much, but that's really the purpose of our symposium in the fall.
Thank you for that. I get a lot of questions from families as a health navigator and a cancer mom. They haven't cured cancer, or so-and-so's tumor is being treated this way. And I always try to explain, and it's hard to find the right words. So I think you did a really great job elaborating on that, that every tumor is different on a molecular level. And trying to explain that to people is can be complicated, because what you just said is a very complicated process. But I think you did a really great job of showing exactly what that means. So speaking of cancer families, there's going to be quite a few, I'm sure, listening in on this podcast. That's, you know, some of our audience. What's something that maybe you would tell them to give them hope for the future of treatment options. Obviously, we've talked a lot about targeted therapies and less toxic and better treatment options, but what are some words of hope that maybe you can give them?
I hope to never understand this myself fully by any means. And I always tell the families, I can't possibly fathom what you're going through. The things I say to all of our new diagnosis families, one, Google is the enemy. Certainly at diagnosis. And what I follow that up with though is this only works through communication. And so talk with your local team. And this is where our nurses and our nurse navigators and our APNs are really so fantastic in that way, of really hearing what the family needs. Your job as a parent is to be your patient's best advocate, your child's best advocate, and our job is to provide the best medical care. And that only works with communication. So if you're worried about something, if you're thinking maybe another institution is the right place for my kid, things like that, talk to your team. You will really be astounded how often, and it's basically always, that they'll be wanting to hear what your concerns are. And either they'll talk it through with you and say, like, this is why that doesn't necessarily make sense. Or more commonly, they'll say, let me reach out to them. Let me see if they got something. You know, it's a small number of cases where we're going to really say, like, oh, we should have sent you there. I mean, it's not really going to be just because of the way that we all collaborate. But if you hold that back and you're not communicating in that way, we can't do as much for you as you deserve and as your child deserves. So number one, communicate. Two, the specter of cancer will haunt you to your dying day. There's no way to get around. For our families where the kid's been cured, every time they have a twinge, every time that something is a little bit different, wait, how many times did you blink that minute? You know, it's you're going to just stare at your kid more and more.
Oh yeah. My brain tumor kiddo goes cross-eyed for fun sometimes. And I'm like, don't do that. That's not cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I like her.
Yeah. Feisty.
And just, you have to find a way to kind of march through that. Three, you have to take care of yourself. It's like on the planes, when the masks come down, if you can't take care of yourself first, you can't help your kid. Find people to talk to. Find your communities. Make sure you're picking those people carefully. Those people should be supportive of you. They shouldn't be second guessing you. They shouldn't be leading you down wild goose chases. Inevitably, every family I've met, someone says, well, my third cousin twice removed said I should be calling this institution or that institution.
Yes.
And maybe you don't talk to that cousin for a little while, but you're going to need breaks.
Yeah.
And it's not selfish to need a break and to take a break. I'm not saying run off to Paris for a month, but that 3 hours at just going to, I don't know, do people go to the mall anymore? I don't know, but go to Starbucks, you know? And just being out of your space and being able to breathe. I don't know if you guys watch Bluey.
Yes, I love Bluey. It's my favorite show.
I am so happy my kid still loves Bluey. But there's that episode where Chili says, I need 20 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what, so you need that. You need to eat. You need to drink. You need to talk to people. You need to take care of yourself in that way. But just keep communicating. Bring your ideas to us. We should be open about it. You know, one at a time. If you bring 20 ideas to us, it's going to be a lot for us to kind of churn through. But a little bit of time, we'll be happy to walk through that. But just keep communicating with us. That's the best thing you can possibly do. And if you feel like you're not getting a square answer, there's going to be someone in that group that you can talk to and get there.
That's great advice. Thank you.
So if you had the chance to leave everyone with one final thought, what would that be?
So I've been thinking about that for a while now in anticipation of the podcast. And it's hard for me because I have so many thoughts. But The top one I would just say is just take care of yourself and build those memories. All of this is hard. And everyone deserves to have a moment to breathe, and you need to take that time. But even through the pain, there'll be moments of happiness, and there'll be those times to really appreciate that. And you're not going to have that chance back. And that can be tricky depending on where you are in your course of treatment and in the course of care for your child. Cause sometimes it's worth that investment of pain to get to years of life and quality later. But sometimes it's you're further on. It's like, well, now is the time to focus on those positive memories. We're hard about that as medical providers ourselves. We don't take care of ourselves. So this always reminds me of a talk that I heard. And so there's a visiting professor, Frank Williams, who's a legend in our field. Really so many paradigm changing discoveries that he's made. And he came and gave us a fantastic talk, really talking about everything he's done and continues to do. And at the end of 50 minutes, he said, you know, the only way I've been able to do this is by having a wife that's understanding and a family that's understanding. And the number of soccer games and recitals and everything that I missed. And if I had to go back and do it again, I wouldn't have done the science and I would have gone to those things. And for someone that powerful and knowing how much impact he had in the field, to say that really is so meaningful. And so you got to find those times to for yourself and for your family.
I love that.
Thank you so much.
Is the perfect ending to our episode. And we thank you all so much for joining in with Dr. Shaw. He's at Nationwide Children's Hospital. I'm going to link his bio in the show notes. And if you have any questions, please comment below. And we look forward to hearing from you. And you can follow our podcast wherever you listen. And we have pages on Facebook and Instagram. Hope you guys have a great day.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, no, thank you. And thank you for opening.